Well, I guess the Garden of Gethsemane is one of the famous gardens, and it was an easy one to find when I was thinking about this idea of gardens. It's a remarkable and a famous garden, and John tells us it was a garden at the foot of the Mount of Olives. And Mark tells us this particular story, and he takes some time to tell it. So he wants us to see something here in what Jesus is doing. And one of the things I think we see is a contrast, an absolute contrast. Jesus was praying, fervent and anguished prayer. His heart was overwhelmed with sorrow. That's a phrase, isn't it? Have you ever prayed a prayer like that? My heart was overwhelmed with sorrow. My sorrow was so big I didn't think I could contain it. His heart was overwhelmed by sorrow. And by the way, I think this was a real prayer. I don't think this is a rhetorical device in the story so that we'll know that Jesus was obedient. I think Jesus was praying this as a real prayer and saying to his Father, if there is another way, please, please, let's do it another way. But he's listening for God's answer as well. And he says, not my will, but yours. But we're kind of surprised, I think, at the disciples. Now, the disciples are a mixed bunch. We know that, don't we? But the contrast is so stark. Jesus is pouring out his heart overwhelmed with sorrow, in fervent prayer, and the disciples have dropped off to sleep. Now, to be fair, who amongst us has not dropped off to sleep during a prayer meeting or a sermon? All right? And I know who you are. All right? So in one sense, we can understand it. But this was an extraordinary moment, wasn't it? They just shared the Last Supper together. Jesus had told them about his suffering and death, and they dropped off to sleep. And Mark wants us to notice this, right? He wants us to see it. He makes the contrast very clear. And there's a contrast between their comfort as they catch 40 winks and Jesus' anguish. And there's a contrast between them, oblivious to what all this means, and Jesus, who is at the centre of what all this means. The obedient Jesus. In some sense, yes, we can forgive them. They're a long way from home. They were from Galilee, after all. A long way to the north. A different region, really. A different culture. And they'd spent a week of ministry with Jesus. And so they fell asleep. Now, one of the things that makes it look bad is particularly the words from the big three. There was Peter and James and John. Remember, they were three disciples that Jesus had called out on several occasions to share something extraordinary with him. And Peter had said, I will never deny you. I will never deny you. James and John had said, let us share in your kingdom with you. And here they were, and they fell asleep. Now, they didn't know, of course, all that it meant. Not until later. And it is true, often with very important things, it's only looking back we realise how important they were. Do you know that? Something significant has happened in your life and you didn't even realise. And you look back and you say, yes, that was the moment where this all changed. That was, and I didn't realise at the time. So that's not uncommon, that we look back and something takes on further, deeper meaning. You know, I remember going to a band concert, a band program at Auburn, and seeing this slim brunette girl who was paying no attention to anything the band was doing up in the congregation. Who would have known that was when I'd meet Sharon and she'd hunt me down? She didn't. It's quite the other way, I assure you. She did offer to carry my bandmaster's briefcase, though. And I think there's something, looking back, I think there was something significant in that. But we know that in our lives, don't we? That sometimes we look back and we see things, yes, And we didn't understand the full meaning of that moment, what it might cost us, what it might mean for us or for our family, all of those things. I read lots of leadership books. Well, I don't anymore, but when I was studying leadership, I did. And one of the things that always struck me about leadership books, and basically a leadership book is a book where a person who's done a leader and done it okay writes a book and tells you their story and says, do it like me. But leadership books are always written in hindsight, all right? And they plot us through the journey of how it worked out. That's what their leadership books are essentially about. But as one speaker on leadership said, everything can look like a failure in the middle. Every new project, every new endeavour, every new journey can look like a failure in the middle. And that's kind of true, really, of when we strike out onto new ventures, start new businesses, or as a church we run new programs or events. Everything can look and feel like a failure in the middle. And actually, the Garden of Gethsemane probably looked like a failure. Here is Jesus. His heart is overwhelmed. His disciples can't even stay awake. Three times he goes to them and says, could you not watch with me? Could you not wait with me? In verse 40 tells us they didn't know what to say. Is that what they did? Kind of a shrug, really? They didn't know what to say. Now soon, very soon, Jesus would be the calm, still, assured presence in the face of turbulent, his arrest, his beating, his trial, his crucifixion, all of that. But that was still yet to come, right? At this moment, when we look at this event, it kind of looked like a failure. But see, Jesus is our role model, isn't he, as Christians? And in this story, I think we need to look at Jesus and not at the disciples. Often we look at the disciples because we're disciples, right? So in a Jesus story, we think, you know, we want to be their role. But we also know we've got to be like Jesus. We've sung it lots of times, haven't we? To be like Jesus, this hope possesses me, we say. So what do we mean when we say that we want to be like Jesus? Do we say, I want to do everything that Jesus did? Now, of course, in some sense, that's not true. Jesus cursed a fig tree. So we wouldn't say every time I walk past a fig tree, I'm going to curse it. Who even knows what a fig tree looks like? I don't. All right. When Jesus came into the temple, he overturned the tables. I would discourage that sort of behaviour. Right? So what do we mean when we say we want to be like Jesus? We want to copy his actions. He is our role model. Well, in this story, I think there is something for us, something rather extraordinary, actually. The first thing that strikes me in this story is that Jesus was brave, in the simplest sense of the word. You see, Jesus was truly and properly man, as well as being truly and properly God. And he felt emotions. We know that. The Gospels tell us that. And he was overwhelmed with sorrow. And he was afraid. And he said, Father, if we can do this a different way, please, let's do it differently. He faced suffering and pain. Now, I'm not sure how I'd go with knowing that I was going to have to face suffering and my death. I hope I'm not forewarned, really. One of the most painful experiences I had was when I was a teenager, and I've told you before that I was a bit of a rascal as a boy, and I'd actually wagged school one day, and I was hanging out behind the shops at Chermside, and it was a hot day in Brisbane, and I stood up too quickly. And have you ever done that thing if you've kind of got low blood pressure? Did you have a head spin? Well, I had a head spin, and I fainted, and I fell face forward onto the concrete. And so I, you know, killed a couple of my teeth and split my lip. And I had to get two stitches in my bottom lip. And these were the days, I'm not exaggerating here, when needles and stitches, everything was much bigger than it is now. And the doctor said, look, so we don't leave a scar from the holes from the stitches themselves. I'll just come back a bit earlier than we normally would, and I'll just pull them out slowly. I don't know if you've ever had a stitch pulled out of your lip slowly. But it hurts. You know, he said, just lie still, this could hurt a bit, as he just pulls it slowly through your lip. I'd like to tell you I was brave. I'd like to tell you that. I don't know how I'd go if I was facing suffering and death. How would you go if you were Jesus and you knew what was in front of you? I think Jesus was brave. Brave in the sense that bravery is not the absence of fear, but the willingness to act in spite of our fear, right? We'd understand that that's what bravery means. The other thing that Jesus did, which is the heart of this story, is that Jesus prayed. And as I've said, I think it's a real prayer seeking an answer, not just a token prayer, or not even an explaining to God prayer. Often our prayers really are just telling God stuff he already knows, aren't they? I mean, he knows everything. So when we pray, we're just telling God stuff he already knows. And we say, God, today I've... And we run through the list and we say, thank you. And it's okay. Right? I don't think God minds that. He loves us. He cares about our lives. But sometimes I think we need to pray at another level. We need to pray more deeply. Prayer sometimes needs to go deeper than that. We need to pray fervently. A long time ago, when I first came back, when I stopped being a rascal and I came back to the church, there was a Congress in Brisbane. And back in those days, they used to have a night of prayer before Congress, you know, when they'd pray for souls, really, that people would get saved. And so we went to this small room in Brisbane City Temple, and there was a lot of older officers, to be honest. And there was me and a friend. We were probably the only young people there. And the commissioner and his entourage came for an hour. And my friend and I were going to see how long we'd last. And we lasted, two or three hours. And I remember at the start, we kind of prayed our best prayers. Lots of these people were experienced prayers, right? So they knew the language of prayer. So they prayed their best prayers, the prayers they know. But then what happened was, when we got through our best prayers, we started to pray, I think, from a deeper place. And we really started to pray the longings of our heart. And in a sense, the prayers became simpler, I think. And I think our prayers actually grew less self-centered, and they became more and more pleading. And they're our best prayers, our truest prayers. And I think sometimes we need that experience of deep prayer. And we pour out our hearts to God, our deepest longings, our deepest hopes. The other thing that happens in this story is I think that Jesus embodies sacrifice. We talked about this before. Sacrifice is giving up, all right? Giving up something. But it's giving up with a purpose, isn't it? Giving up for a reason. Sacrifice is putting aside our own desires to be faithful and obedient, even in pain, even as we step into the unknown. So sacrifice is to say, not my will but yours, to set aside our preference, our will, to follow God's will. And I think sacrifice and bravery are natural partners here. And they lead to obedience. And I mean the true obedience, the true committed obedience. I mean a real obedience, not reluctant ones. There's different types of obedience, isn't there, I think, sometimes. I used to be a school teacher, and sometimes you'd have to deal with naughty children. You have to tell them to do something they didn't want to do. And so you'd say to the boy, and often it was a boy, let's be honest, and you'd say to him, go and do this, go and stand there and go and do this thing. And something that used to just really kind of grind my gears was when it was kind of this passive-aggressive thing, when they do it but as slowly as possible. You know, go to the back of the room. You know? Wasn't really obedience, was it? They weren't getting the whole spirit of the thing. It's a real obedience, I think, which is kind of a committed decision, born out of sacrifice, born out of love. Jesus tells this interesting story in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 21. It's a parable of the two sons, and who are given instruction by their father, and one son says no. But then he goes and does it anyway. There's another son that says yes, but doesn't do it. All right? There's different types of obedience, the obedience of action, the obedience of willingness to go. And I think real sacrifice has a real cost, and it leads to an obedience freely given. And that was what the early Christian writers could see in Jesus. And so the writer to the Philippians, well, Paul, when he takes this hymn, and lots of people think it was a hymn that he already knew, and it's in Philippians chapter 2. It says your attitude should be like Jesus, who was obedient to death, even death on a cross. And what they marveled at was the cross, but not the cross, but his willingness to go there, right? His obedience. And his sacrificial obedience, I think, is at the heart of the Christian story. And if we really do want to be like Jesus, I think there's going to be some sacrificial obedience in following him. The question for us is there anything we must be prepared to sacrifice for a better future, for God's preferred future? What do we need to sacrifice for us to put aside in our own lives? What about for our family and for our friends? What about for our church? I mean, I think we've known this idea of sacrifice, putting something aside for a better future. We've known this as a core, haven't we? You know, when we left our buildings at 34 Smith Street, coming here for 9 months while the building was finished. You know, sacrifice for a better future. All right, we'll do this because we know that God's got something in store for us. So we've lived that, I think. And I think these three aspects of this story tell us something important about Jesus. And I know that we normally talk about this story as part of the whole Eastern narrative of God's great salvation plan. But it's a remarkable enough story to learn something from the story just on its own. And I think we need to learn something from Jesus. Because what happened here? What did Jesus do? At the decisive point of his ministry and mission, Jesus was on his knees in fervent prayer, determined to be obedient to his Father's will. And I believe that that is an example to be copied. At the decisive point of his ministry and mission, Jesus was on his knees in fervent prayer, determined to be obedient to his Father's will. Sharon and I attended a two-day conference this week organised by our division, and it's about, it was core officers basically in the room along with some of our line managers, area officers. And it was about leading large corps and how the army could help us. I took it as an opportunity for me to help the army as well, to help them see how they could help us. And so it was a fruitful time of conversation. But one of the speakers was a guy from Brisbane, and he was the founding pastor and the senior pastor of a church in Brisbane's north called Bridgman Downs Baptist. It's a very large church, and in fact, there's a whole lot of Salvationists who go there. They could start a corps with a number of people who go to Bridgman Downs Baptist. But he was an inspiring and lovely and gracious and godly man. And he was talking about this time in their church. They'd planted their church in the early 90s, and it had grown steadily, and it had plateaued at about 150 people, and it remained at 150 people for some time. And some of the leaders really felt that God was calling them to divide the congregation so that there was the potential for more growth. And this was a big decision in the life of their church. So they sought God's will. They got on their knees and they sought God's will. And they invited everybody from the church to come and pray. And they committed to praying for 10 hours in one day, that they would pray for 10 hours. And people were invited along to come for the whole 10 hours or to come when they could. And they fervently begged God for a sign. They wanted to be obedient. Show us the way, Lord. What should we do? And they received a sign, actually. They received a sign. Someone spoke into that moment, and they made that decision. And it was made easy because everybody there knew that this was an answer to prayer. This was God at work here. So for this big decision, at this decisive point in their ministry, they prayed. Now, I'm going to retire in 7 years. All right, at 67, I turned 60 this year. I know, you're shocked. And I was thinking, what will our call be like in 7 years' time? And I tried to imagine it. So just imagine with me what our core might be like in 7 years' time. So here I am, I've come back and I'm a grumpy retired officer, right? Not all retired officers are grumpy, I just want to point that out. I'm very grateful for the ones we have here. But just, I think you can imagine me as a grumpy retired officer. I don't think that's a big step. So just imagine Jane has come back, all right? So Jane's, she's been spent 4 years doing overseas mission. And so she's come back to Australia to see our core. And what would Jane see when she comes back? What does she find? Well, Hayley Entwistle's just finishing her PhD. And she's now our worship coordinator. And Ben Eden is engaged to a girl who got saved through our university chaplaincy ministry. And he's now leading two of our four congregations. And Kerry Parker is still leading Ladies Fellowship. And it's tripled in size. And there's over 20 small groups and community tables. And we have lots of discipleship groups, language-based discipleship groups, in Mandarin and Cantonese and Gujarati and Punjabi and Farsi and Arabic and Swahili. And Jane, to visit her old ministry, goes back to English conversation classes. And there's six of them now running. And fortunately, the young adults retreat is on. So she goes to the young adults retreat and there's 47 people there. And she goes to visit with Ryan Keast, who is now our full-time youth pastor. I have to tell you, when I said that at the 9:30 congregation, there was a strong response, particularly from Ryan. Iwe is the bandmaster of our community band. Our second community band. We have 70 in our Christmas choir for our Christmas spectacular that's run over three nights due to popular demand. Is that possible? Is that possible? I mean, the names could be changed, right? I'm not a prophet. I'm not saying that that will happen. The names could be changed. But is that possible? By the grace of God, it's my hope. But the question is, how will we know? How will we make these decisions at this decisive point in our ministry and mission as we contemplate the fact that, God willing, in August this year, we will move back into our new building? How will we know? So as I said, this was a personal challenge to me, this idea of fervent prayer. So here's what I'm going to do, and I'd love you to join me. You don't have to. I understand that for all sorts of logistical and practical reasons, you might not be able to. But for the period of Lent, which starts the Sunday after next, every Sunday morning up until Easter, I'm going to pray from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock in MP1 out the back. And it's just going to be a prayer meeting. It's not going to be a creative prayer exercise. I'm just going to pray. And if nobody comes to pray with me, that's all right. I'll pray for our core. I'll pray for you all by name. I'll pray the Psalms. I'll have lots to pray for. But I'd love you to come and pray with me. And the purpose of this prayer is that we seek God's will. Not ours. We seek God's will. And that we genuinely hear God's leading. Hear from him. At this decisive point in our ministry together as a core, we must be on our knees in fervent prayer, determined to be obedient to our Father's will. So let's be brave. Let's be prayerful and obedient as we follow God into his future for us. I want us to sing a song, and the band's going to help us sing the two verses and the chorus. But then I want us to sing the chorus several times unaccompanied at the end of that. And while we all sing, all of us, everyone gathered in this room, I wonder when we sing these unaccompanied choruses, that if you would respond, and bandsmen, I'd love you to do this for me too. I'd love you to respond with your bodies. I'd love you, if you feel capable, to kneel in prayer, or to clasp your hands in prayer, or to bow your heads, or to open up your palms and put them on your knees, or to come to the holiness table, or to kneel at your chair. In some way, as we sing that chorus twice through, I'll follow thee, of life the giver. I'll follow thee, suffering redeemer. I'll follow thee, deny thee never. As we sing that twice through, unaccompanied, respond and pray for our core. pray that we will hear, God.